You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
The Patriotic Millionaires also purchase advertising time on various Civic Media stations throughout Wisconsin.
What's up, Wisconsin? I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. It is the 3 o'clock hour, and that means it's Maggie and the Millionaires talking money, 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 because it's always about the money. I am really excited to be joined today by Bob Lord, Senior Vice President for Tax Policy at the Patriotic Millionaires, as well as Scott Ellis, one of the founding board members of the Excessive Wealth Disorder Institute, himself a Patriotic Millionaire. Welcome back to the show, gentlemen. I'm so excited to have you because I love talking about the Supreme Court. It is so important that people understand that the court has been moving the goalpost quite a bit for the middle class.
Thanks, Maggie. I find it a little painful to talk about the Supreme Court, but it is important.
I guess I mean that love in sort of like air quotes. It's important to talk about the Supreme Court. As a legal nerd, I love tearing apart what are, in my opinion, some of the most porous and ill-reasoned decisions that we have seen. I think some of the court's decisions are going to go down in that same vein of Plessy versus Ferguson under the harsh blaring light of historical review. But Bob and Scott, we wanted to talk specifically about corruption at the Supreme Court and one particular case. I want to start with you, Bob. As a tax lawyer for over 30 years, how bad is the current level of corruption at the Supreme Court, especially the influence of basically this small cadre of billionaires? And why does that matter for average people?
Well, in my estimation, it's a horrible level of corruption. You have one individual, Leonard Leo, who I don't think he founded the Federalist Society, but he made it what it is. And he's kind of acted as a coordinator between the court and a handful of billionaires, led by Harlan Crow and a couple others. Paul Singer is another one. And they've showered these couple justices with gifts. Most significantly, Clarence Thomas. I think the number is up to like $4 million in gifts that Clarence Thomas has received.
And failed to disclose. I mean, it's not just the receipt of gift. It's, oh, I just forgot to put that on my disclosure form.
And even when it was brought to his attention with ProPublica's reporting that he hadn't reported the gifts that ProPublica found out about, he still didn't report some that they hadn't found out about it until they ultimately did.
Right. When you're called on it, you might want to do, you know, a detailed review of your disclosure statements and make sure that they are indeed complete before you put on the airs of righteous indignation. Why does that matter to an average Wisconsinite or American?
Well, the Supreme Court is making some very important decisions that involve the interests of these same billionaires who and the interests of Leonard Leo going forward. So, you know, you have a tax case like the Moore case come before the Supreme Court, and the outcome of the decision itself could preempt some of the proposals that have been floated in Congress to tax these billionaires more substantially.
which is so important. And yet the Moore case seems to open up this potential Pandora's box of tax dodging. Scott, let me ask you this. We've been talking about, you know, that there is a level of wealth where too much is just simply too much. We've talked with other experts, including yourself in this very segment, about how this ultra enormous wealth is actually fairly anti-democratic, because once you've bought your 100th Rolls Royce and your, you know, 1,000th vacation home, or your, you know, the next huge diamond for your jewelry collection, the next Rolex, money actually has this bizarre sort of diminishing marginal return at the very, very ultra wealthy levels, which you've defined as folks with a net worth of over $30 million. And what you're left with after you've acquired these billions or hundreds of millions of dollars, is the idea that, well, I've got all this money, I might as well get myself some access. And by access, they mean access to the levers of power in government. That is not one person, one vote, right? And here we see this corruption playing out in a very direct way at the Supreme Court. With your work with the Excessive Wealth Institute, are you at all surprised to see this? Is the directness of it a little surprising? Because I have to tell you, I was pretty shocked when that first ProPublica report dropped this past March. I thought, wow, you didn't even try to hide it.
Absolutely. So I'm not at all surprised. I think the important thing is people are starting to see what's happening. One of our colleagues, Chuck Collins, runs an organization called inequality.org, and he's written a lot about the wealth defense industry. This is not an accident, right? Folks know exactly what they're doing, and they work very, very hard, first of all, to acquire wealth, to hoard it and conceal it and defend it, and then to use it to gather more power and more wealth. And so it's very intentional, very systematic. And I think a lot of what I'm trying to focus on, and Excessive Wealth Disorder Institute is trying to talk about as well, is to help people become aware of what's happening. Because we need to understand this is what's happening. And there's a part which is we read the news clips and people have billions of dollars and it doesn't seem to resonate. And so helping people understand how much wealth that is, stopping yes. and asking how much is enough, and then saying, wait a minute, if people have too much, as you say, they can't really buy more things that make their lives better. Money just becomes a way of executing power and using it to influence their lives and ours. And we all need to decide whether we're okay with that.
Yeah, that fundamental idea, are we okay with certain extraordinarily wealthy people having unique and basically covered up access to our elected officials and government. And in the, as a lawyer, I'm so disgusted by this direct corruption of the Supreme Court. And I just wanted to ask you, Bob, this isn't just the Moore case, though I want to ask you a couple more questions about that particular case. This kind of corruption is also seeping in through law schools and speaker gigs and the, I forget what the actual name is, but it's like the Supreme Court Historical Society that was newly created, alleged to be sort of the brainchild also of Leonard Leo, taking in millions of dollars. There's this whole kind of racket set up to provide donors and those that help stand up these new law schools or these new chairs within law schools, access to these judges. And I don't just mean indirect access and a wink, wink, nudge, nudge. I mean, they're literally rubbing elbows at cocktail parties.
That's true. They're also creating a pipeline of judges who are predisposed to rule the way they want them to rule. You have a handful of judges, justices on the circuit courts and the Supreme Court, who hire clerks, and it's a very prestigious position. And once you've been in that position, it's not. The pathway is cleared to go out perhaps into the private sector for 5 or 10 years, perhaps, you know, in government, you know, like at Department of Justice. But then ultimately, return to the court as a judge or ultimately a Supreme Court justice. And they don't have to lobby those judges and justices anymore because they're brethren at that point.
Yeah, they've been locked in. They've been literally bred to do this dirty work for what is the modern American oligarchy. Small tangent of a story, gentlemen. I myself was a federal appeals court clerk. I was considered for a fellowship in the Solicitor General's office. I was also considered for a Supreme Court clerkship. I didn't go to Yale, right? And so the more liberal leading justices were like, who's this chick that went to the University of Wisconsin that wasn't our pipeline? And I got heavily vetted by the conservatives, and there was a Republican appointee running the SG's office at the time. So my name got quickly like crossed off the list. But it was very interesting to see some of my colleagues, whom will remain nameless, go through this exact vetting process that you're discussing. This is not sort of Bob, Scott, and I hypothesizing here. I know people who are literally in this pipeline, who are Federalist Society members and have been vetted, trained, and are ready to be dispatched should Donald Trump win another election. Before we go to break, set up exactly what was the issue in Moore v. United States, Bob, and what the case seemed to be about. And then after break, we'll talk about what it really is about. What did the case seemingly, was it about?
Sure. On the surface, the case was about a relatively obscure tax that came about in the 2017 Tax Act called the Mandatory Repatriation Tax, which was a tax on individual shareholders of a significant amount, over 10% of the stock of foreign corporations. And it was basically a transition rule to go from a system where ultimately the income of those corporations would be taxable to their U.S. shareholders to where it wouldn't be. And they needed a tax that would basically reach the earnings up to the end of 2017. And that's what the case was about, the constitutionality of this mandatory repatriation tax.
It's funny, the words repatriation, I don't think anybody would have heard of up until last week. And Wisconsin's Senate candidate, Eric Hovde, apparently knows quite a bit about repatriation with shady banks that may or may not do business with Mexican drug cartels. That's not what today is about. We'll talk more about the details of Moore v. United States and what it was actually about after these brief messages. In the rich man's world, Monday, 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 always Sunday. In the rich man's world, all the things I can do. If I had a little money, it's a rich man's world. At least I try to work hard for my money for each and every one of you every day here on the Maggie Dawn Show. On the Civic Media Radio Network, we're in the 3 o'clock block, folks. So that means it is Maggie and the Millionaires talking money. Today, I've got special guest Bob Lohr, Senior VP for Tax Policy at the Patriotic Millionaires, and our friend Scott Ellis, one of the founding board members of the Excessive Wealth Disorder Institute and a Patriotic Millionaire himself. We've been talking about corruption at the Supreme Court and how through a series of cases, especially one in this past term, Moore v. United States, the court has been not so subtly, if you're into the weeds of legal jargon and Supreme Court cases, not so subtly shifting things to benefit billionaires and ultra-millionaires. We've been talking about the details behind the case Moore v. United States, which seemed to be simply about repatriation relating to folks that owned stock or were shareholders of more than 10% of foreign-based corporations. But Bob, you were explaining before the break, that's not really what the case was about. Tell us more.
Sure. It wasn't about that at all. What it really was about are the arguments that were made to say that this mandatory repatriation tax was unconstitutional. And there were basically two of them. One is that because the earnings were not actually being distributed, the taxation of the earnings was the equivalent of taxing the wealth of these shareholders. And therefore, if it's a wealth tax, it is something called a direct tax, which under the Constitution is very hard to make constitutional. So the upshot of that argument is wealth taxes are unconstitutional. The second argument is that because the earnings hadn't been distributed, the income had not been realized by these shareholders. And the 16th Amendment, which provides for the income tax, only applies to realized income, not unrealized income. So those were, and what the intent was to win on either or both of these arguments and create a situation where current tax proposals, such as Elizabeth Warren's ultra-millionaires tax, which is a tax on wealth, or President Biden's billionaire minimum income tax, which is effectively, which arguably is a tax on unrealized gains, render those unconstitutional preemptively. That was the intention. What actually happened was the majority of the justices found a way to say that the mandatory repatriation tax was constitutional without officially reaching any of those arguments. But the opinions make clear that four of the nine justices are ready to go for the billionaires and rule both wealth taxes and taxes on unrealized gains are unconstitutional. And Brett Kavanaugh, in his opinion, suggested very, very strongly that he would rule wealth taxes are unconstitutional, and there's a pretty decent chance would also find a way to say that taxes on unrealized gains are unconstitutional. And by the way, by unrealized gains, we're talking about someone who bought Amazon for $1 a share and it's now worth $500 a share, and they're not paying tax simply because they haven't sold the Amazon stock yet.
But it, of course, allows them to borrow against that at infinitesimal interest rates. There's all sorts of gamesmanship. We've talked about so very much of that on the show. Would I be incorrect in hazarding a guess that in addition to Brett Kavanaugh, we absolutely have Justices Thomas and Alito also siding on the side of, oh, it's unconstitutional to tax wealth or unrealized income?
Well, the four that are, that I'd say are kind of in the bag for the billionaires are Thomas, Gorsuch, Alito, and Coney Barrett.
Very interesting. I would have generally thought of Kavanaugh in the bag as well, simply because of his, again, I'll call it grooming over many decades. He is one of those good old boys from the Federalist Society. Scott, when we look at this, and you and I have talked about potential policy options, when we look at these people that have wealth that basically has exceeded their ability to ever spend it, has exceeded the needs of even generations of their family. Again, wealth, we're talking extreme and extraordinary multitudes of millions, if not billions of dollars. When you hear these arguments about the constitutionality and we're looking at the makeup of the court, how important is this next presidential election and simply the idea of economic fairness to those that work for paychecks and wages here in the United States?
I mean, it's critically important. I mean, this is the mechanism through which individuals are appointed to the Supreme Court, which then becomes a vehicle for implementing policies like this to enable the excessively wealthy to gather wealth, to protect it, and to increase that wealth and then use it. And so this is what it's about. And at some level, you'd say, we are in a democracy. The most important thing that we as citizens have is the vote, and we need to use it. And at some point, I'd say, listening to Bob, make no mistake, there is a reason these people are doing what they're doing. They know that the solution to this problem is tax policy. They do not want to let us use it. And I think we all need to realize what's happening. We can try and play whack-a-mole and try and address corporate compensation committees. And then we'll try and deal with the climate change thing over here and address wealth over there. Ultimately, government is good at certain things. One of the things governments can do is collect taxes. This is a very straightforward way of thinking about the world, and it's critically important. Citizens need to be aware of the problem, understand how important it is, and see that the role that we all have is to vote to try and make the change we need.
We can look back to Citizens United, where money was declared to be equivalent to speech. And what I say to everyone listening out there, based on what Bob Lord has shared with us, the Senior Vice President for Tax Policy at Patriotic Millionaires, what Scott Ellis has shared with us, one of the founding board members of the Excessive Wealth Disorder Institute, a rich guy himself and a patriotic millionaire, is this. If billionaires get to scream at policymakers because money is speech, the only solution that you and I have, the regular people, working people, is that we need to gather our voices together, $1 and one vote at a time, if you will, and send an unequivocally clear message that we want a fair tax system. We want the richest corporations and the richest Americans to pay their fair share. We have had enough. Gentlemen, thank you so much. I can't wait to continue the discussion soon. Folks, you're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Been the one to say the first goodbye. Had to love and lose 100 million times. Had to get it wrong to know just what I like. Now I'm falling. You say my name like I have
never. What is up, Wisconsin? Welcome back to the Maggie Dawn Show. Welcome if you're just joining us. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. We are hoping to be joined shortly by Greg Jackson, the Deputy Director of the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention. We're going to keep our eyes out for Greg. We hope he is arriving soon. The reason that Greg is joining us is that today, President Biden made a statement talking about what has been accomplished by the White House Office of Gun Prevention over the last year. It was established a year ago, and Vice President Harris took a key leadership role in ensuring that the public safety that we all deserve in every neighborhood is something that we can achieve. And that, my friends, requires gun violence prevention. And it's not just about common sense gun regulations that we all generally agree with, right? It's not just about that. It's about early interventions and a lot of other tactics that have been deployed in cities like Milwaukee to help try to address gun violence. This is a topic and an issue that's especially close to my heart because the Office of Violence Prevention was one of the first at the city of Milwaukee was one of the first established in the nation. And it was originally run by a good friend of mine, a guy by the name of Reggie Moore. He now heads up an institute studying this at Freidert and the Medical College of Wisconsin. So I look forward to speaking with Greg Jackson as soon as he can join us. And listen, if you're listening and you may be yelling at your radios, well, there's still a lot of crime and things happening and what are the results and how do we, yeah, there is still crime, but violence prevention is not a light switch. It's not something that you do overnight. It takes, frankly, folks that are willing to actually talk about the origins of gun violence and to take the active steps over years in communities to make the sorts of investments to stop this epidemic of gun violence. I see that Mr. Greg Jackson has joined us. I am so happy to have you, sir. You're going to want to unmute, of course. We've got that in these days. There you go.
Hey.
Greg Jackson, hey, friend, Deputy Director of the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention. Welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show, sir. I super appreciate you making time. Big press conference today talking about the accomplishments of this office led by Vice President Harris since the year of its founding 1 year ago. Tell us, what are some of the accomplishments? What are the steps that have been taken by the White House's Office of Gun Violence Prevention? You're good to go, sir.
Okay, no, I think we broke up a little bit there, but yeah, excited to be here. Excited for these executive orders and actions. You know, I think just to give you a quick overview, I mean, this administration has been committed to addressing this crisis since day one. This is the first president in history to name this as a public health crisis on December 21st of 2020. And since then, we've implemented over 40 executive actions. We rolled out an additional $30 billion for public safety and passed the first law on gun violence in 30 years, the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. But this is another step building on that momentum, where we will be rolling out executive orders to really focus on emerging firearm threats. We have seen machine gun conversion devices popping up in communities across the country. I mean, just this weekend in Birmingham, Alabama, four individuals were killed and 18 injured at the hands of one of these machine gun conversion devices, or commonly known as Glock switches. But we're also looking at 3D printed firearms as part of this effort. And through this executive order, we will start to launch a interagency government-wide effort to crack down on how these devices are getting into our communities and creating, literally creating weapons of war in neighborhoods throughout our country. We're also gonna be looking at school safety and how can we strengthen school safety, and specifically active shooter drills. The vice president, she traveled the country, and throughout all of her youth visits and college visits, she saw that nearly every young person had experienced this active shooter drill. But what we also know is that there's very little research on how effective these drills are, how much harm they're causing, what trauma that youth are experiencing, and how prepared they are equipping our student leaders and our education leaders in dealing with these threats and these violent moments. And so we'll be launching an effort to really look at how do we strengthen the research, refine these practices, make sure they're as effective as possible, but also so we minimize the harm and trauma of our youth that are having to experience these exercises and frankly are thinking every day about the threat of being shot in the classrooms. And so those are two orders, but there will also be a dozen executive actions announced as part of this. Everything from expanding resources for community violence intervention programs to strengthening our ability to trace and track injuries from firearms across the country, as well as rolling out important resources for survivors and communities that have been impacted by violence on how we can help them heal, recover, and really bounce back from these tragedies that we know nearly 100,000 or over 100,000 Americans are experiencing every year.
Mr. Jackson, you mentioned there's so much there, right? And one thing that I wanted to lean into a bit is intervention, and this idea that gun violence prevention is not just accomplished by enforcing our criminal codes or enforcing our gun regulations, that there is what I'm going to call an upstream intervention. We know that trauma replicates itself and accelerates sometimes genetically across families within neighborhoods, and that this intervention aspect, the getting involved before the violence happens, is so critical. If you could speak to that a bit, sir, I would appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, we know that there's a couple ways that we can get there. One, you know, when it comes to violence, it's very simple. There is typically a person in a moment of crisis that has easy access to a firearm. And so the intervention work is really where we focus on that moment of crisis and how do we help that person either not get there or help them navigate through that moment. And so one of the key interventions, if they're having a mental health crisis, that's why we created and funded the 988 Crisis Lifeline. So you have someone you can call. If you're in schools, that's why we added 14,000 school-based mental health professionals. So you have a trusted voice that you can talk to in your schools. If you're out there in a community, that's why we're funding community violence intervention programs that can connect with you with trusted messengers that can help you de-escalate and think about, okay, what is this conflict? What is this crisis? How do we solve it without causing legal harm? And then even in hospitals, when we know that someone's been harmed or shot, that's a key moment to intervene. When a loved one walks in and sees their family or their friend injured, harmed, or worse, lost to gun violence, the first idea is to retaliate and to get that vengeance. But having hospital-based violence intervention programs can engage that person and de-escalate and cool things down before they react emotionally. So we're investing in all of these intervention efforts while we're also thinking about how do we keep firearms away from that person in that moment of crisis. And that's why things like making gun trafficking a federal offense are key, because that's how we keep guns out of the hands of those who are already prohibited or already at risk or already at vulnerable or vulnerable and can't take the legal means to get a firearm. That's why we enhanced our background check system for purchasers under 21. So now we can look at their mental health records, look at their juvenile criminal history to decide whether or not they can legally buy a gun during that background check, because that's a way to make sure they're not in that moment of crisis when they're making that decision to purchase. And so we're continuously looking at ways that we can, again, look upstream to make sure that access to firearms aren't easily available in that moment of crisis. And how do we help people navigate that moment of crisis without harming themselves or others?
Mr. Jackson, thank you so much. That is Greg Jackson, the Deputy Director of the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention. I have one observation and then one greeting that I'd like to pass along to you, sir. Here's my first observation. As we ask folks to not seek retribution and vengeance, to not try to get even, and we are building systems to provide care, to interrupt that cycle, it seems to me an incredible irony that we have a presidential candidate that embraces vengeance, violence, and retribution. And the greeting that I wish to pass along to you is I worked with my good friend Reggie Moore for a few years at the city of Milwaukee, who's one of the fathers, I will say, if that is an okay way to express it, of the violence prevention movement. And so from us folks here in Wisconsin and the city of Milwaukee and from Mr. Moore himself, thank you, sir, for your great works. Please continue to help make our community safer. This is what public safety is about, everybody.
Will do. Will do. Thank you so much, Maggie, and thanks for sharing those greetings as well.
Yeah, Reggie's the real deal. Thanks so much, Greg. Nice to see you, friend. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Folks, that was Greg Jackson, again, the Deputy Director of the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention. What a treat to have him joining us. Let me take a break. I promised you all some breaking news. We've shared some of the sound I read to you before from Kamala Harris's address in Pennsylvania today, addressing what her economic plans are to help the middle class. I want to share some of those policy proposal highlights with you before we get to the end of the show. And then in our next segment, you're going to want to stick here because I'm going to be talking about the American Stability Act, this absolutely groundbreaking legislation introduced today by Representative Summer Lee, a congressperson from Pennsylvania's 12th congressional district. Here are the policy proposals that Vice President Harris discussed today in Pennsylvania. Here's how she's going to lower the cost of food and groceries. She's going to advance the first ever federal ban on price gouging, specifically about food and groceries. We talked about that on this show. We know that that's happening. There have been very clear evidence that this has been happening. We've heard it on the earnings calls from some of these corporations. She's going to set clear rules of the road to make clear that big corporations cannot unfairly exploit consumers to run up these excessive profits on food and groceries. And she's going to seek new authority for the Federal Trade Commission and state attorneys general to investigate and impose strict new penalties on companies that break these rules. Second, she's going to lower the cost of renting and owning a home. She's going to lower the rent for Americans by taking on these massive corporate conglomerates that have bought up housing stocks across the country that are engaging effectively in price fixing scheme. They have been, again, marking up housing costs way above market. This is effectively collusion. It is not capitalism. It is abusive of the middle class. She's going to fight that. She's going to provide $25,000 in down payment support for first-time homeowners. Folks, man, I bet a bunch of us could use that help. She's going to put money back. This is number three. She's going to put money back into the pockets of hardworking families through a new $6,000 child tax credit for families with children in the first year of life. She will restore the American Rescue Plan's expanded child tax credit, which means up to $3,600 per child for middle class and the hardest working Americans, not the ultra wealthy, not the tax cuts for the ultra wealthy that Trump promises. She's going to cut taxes for frontline workers by expanding the earned income tax credit to cover individuals and couples in lower income jobs who aren't raising a child in their home, cutting taxes for those folks by up to $1,500. She's going to help Americans afford health insurance on the Obamacare marketplace by helping them save an average of $700 on their health insurance premium, totaling over $6,000 per year in savings that the Affordable Care Act is providing, which, by the way, Donald Trump tried to get repealed some 56 times while he was in office. Four, she's going to continue to help lower the cost of prescription drugs and relieve medical debt, capping the cost of insulin at $35 and out-of-pocket expenses for prescription drugs at $2,000. And folks, she's going to help support Black-owned businesses by expanding the tax deduction for startups and small businesses from $5,000 to $50,000. Because who can start a business off 5Gs? Nobody. We're going to talk about the Sustainability Act when we come back. Keep it locked. You cannot miss a minute of the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm Maggie Dawn, your host of the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. It's been a barn burner of a day, and the news just does not stop, everybody. My thanks to our great list of guests. We had, of course, our special guest from Emily's List, Christina Reynolds, because it sounds like change. She's going to be here every Wednesday with me at 2:30. We had our Maggie and the Millionaires Patriotic Millionaires segment with Bob Lord, a tax policy expert, as well as Scott Ellis, one of the founding board members of the Excessive Wealth Disorder Institute. And of course, Greg Jackson from the White House's Office of Gun Violence Prevention joining us just at the bottom of the hour. Thanks to all. And of course, kicking it off, who can ever forget former Illinois Congressman and our good friend, Joe Walsh. I can't wait to talk to Joe more as we approach the election. But everybody, here is what I think government can be very much represented today in a piece of legislation introduced by Pennsylvania Congresswoman Summer Lee, the first Black woman ever elected to Congress from Western Pennsylvania. She was born and raised in the Mon Valley of Pennsylvania. She spent her early professional career as an attorney and a community organizer. She was in the state legislature in Pennsylvania. She graduated from Penn State and Howard University School of Law. She introduced what is called the American Stability Act. But let's start with some context before I get into the details of this legislation. Since the 1970s, productivity and worker wages have become decoupled. It should be the case that as worker productivity goes up, so do wages, hopefully in similar proportions, right? I mean, that only makes sense. Because the more productive we are as workers, the more the folks that own corporations make. So we should also share in those corporate profits through wages. But today, more than 40% of working Americans make less than the median cost of living for a single adult with no children. And more than 70% of Americans make less than the median cost of living for a single adult with one child. The fact of the matter is that the bottom has simply fallen out of the wage floor, leaving the middle class workers feeling like we're getting screwed, like we have nothing to stand on, like we cannot make it work. We cannot make our paychecks stretch. And at the same time, our tax system is awash with unmerited giveaways and tax breaks for the richest, most consistently profitable corporations and the ultra wealthy. Now, the bill that Representative Lee has introduced, called the American Stability Act, is a powerful, common sense legislative solution to the ongoing threat to our democracy and to capitalism that is posed by this increasing level of economic inequality that plagues our country. If you feel like you're not getting ahead, you're not imagining that. That's because the tax code isn't built for the middle class. Now, this American Stability Act combines tax and wage reforms into a single piece of legislation. And the goal of this legislation is to establish what should be a common sense and stable relationship between labor and capital that should permanently protect American workers from this uneven globalized economy, rapid technological change, and the power that is wielded in our political system by the ultra wealthy. I call this absolutely groundbreaking. It's transformative. We need to alleviate taxes on working people, shifting that responsibility to the ultra, ultra wealthy. If you're trying to help your kids buy a home, get them through college without debt, leave a little behind for your family. I'm not talking about that. I'm not even talking about 2, 3, 4, 5 million. I'm talking about the ultra wealthy. It is time that they paid their fair share. Take, for example, the fact that the minimum wage in this country has not been raised since 2009. Why do we have a minimum wage? Why don't we have a stability wage? A stability wage that ensures that the middle class is indeed stable. So let's look at what the American Stability Act proposes to do. First, it establishes a cost of living exemption for federal taxes equal to the median cost of living for a single adult with no children. Duh. What this means is if you're making less that it costs to live, you don't pay taxes. I want you to think about that. If you make less money than it costs to live today, why are you paying a penny in taxes? You shouldn't. It's that simple. Secondly, the American Stability Act shifts tax responsibility, that tax responsibility, onto taxpayers that make more than $1 million a year. It replaces the federal minimum wage with that stability wage that I'm talking about. We're going to start it at $20 an hour. And it indexes the stability wage to inflation or to the increase in the average wage for all workers. And it eliminates most exceptions to wage law, which allows employers to pay some classes of worker less than others. We'll talk about this again tomorrow. Because this is just...
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.